Environment and Public Affairs Committee here in WA. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for waiting for us. We've been trying to get one of or two of your other participants, or just one, on the line, but I don't think we've quite been successful yet. So I hope you can all hear me, welcome to the committee. I know we're all on Zoom and that has its limitations, so we'll try and work our way through that.
Gallery view.
We do appreciate you taking the time today to be with us. So I'd like to just start by reading an opening statement that our committee often always does. So if you just bear with me. So on behalf of the committee, I'd like to welcome you into the hearing. These proceedings are being recorded by our Hansard, and a copy of the audio will be placed on our website. As we are meeting by Zoom today, I'd like to advise you that present with me at this end of the link up are our reporting and committee staff and the following members of the committee. So to my right here is the Honourable Samantha Rowe, and to my left is the Deputy Chair, the Honourable Colin Holt, and to the far end over there is the Honourable Tim Clifford. One of our other committee members is an apology today. So before we begin, can each of you please state your full name and your position for us so that we can just make sure we've got everyone that needs to be here. We can't see two of you, so if you can do that. So is it Miss Begg? Could you start perhaps? I can see you in our top left-hand corner. Are you able to?
Yes, I can. Thank you for the opportunity. The name is Rishida Begg. I'm the Division Manager for Core Business Support at the Parliament of South Africa. Just a little about, a bit about Core Business Support. It comprises the committees of both houses, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, Legal Services, the Public Participation Section, and a small office supporting the legal government business. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that. I think we've just been joined by Miss Taya. So my apologies for my pronunciation of each and every one of your names. I'm not very good at English names, let alone non-English names, so please bear with me. So I think we've just been joined by Miss Taya. Is that how you say your name? You're muted. If we can just unmute you.
Good morning, I can hear you. It's Jawa.
Thank you.
Correct. Yeah, my name is Baby Jawa. I am the Acting Secretary to Parliament, that means the Acting DG to Parliament. I head the administration of Parliament, which are officials that support members. It cuts across from secretaries of committees, researchers, content advisors, and everybody else employed by Parliament. Our Parliament constitutes about 1,300 officials in various categories, supporting 495 members of Parliament and of the two houses, the National Council of Provinces and the National Assembly. Mm-hmm. So we separate the administration arm from the procedural arm. Each house has got a procedural secretary who manages the running of the two houses. They all report to the DG, who then is an overall administrator, head of administration. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. And I think, is it Ms. Steris Jaffo? Is that how you say it? You're muted at the moment. Can we unmute?
Jaffa, I'm the researcher to the Select Committee on Petitions and Executive Undertakings. I'm also currently the Acting Content Advisor in that position as well.
All right, thank you. And I think we have one more here. It does say Alexander on the screen, but is that person? Sorry, I can't see them. So, oh, there you are. I just unmute them, please. Sorry, we can't. Thank you.
Good morning. I am the Executive Assistant to the Acting Secretary to Parliament.
All right, excellent. Thank you. And do we have the chairperson there as well?
I've been trying to get hold of the chairperson telephonically. I don't know if you saw me on my
yes,
cell phone,
yes.
But I was speaking to her executive secretary, trying to get hold of her, and she was busy on a call when I tried to call her earlier.
Okay.
So I can try once again.
Look, I mean, I think she knows we're going, and what we don't want to do is get too far behind in our time scale, because your time is important, and we've got another witness that we've got scheduled after you. So what we'll do is we'll proceed, and if she joins us, we'll deal with her in terms of our procedures then. So I think you've all been given a document called Information for Witnesses. Have you all had an opportunity to read and understand that document? Just a nod will do, or a yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So if for some reason you wish to make a confidential statement during today's discussion, and we don't really anticipate that you will, but if you do, your evidence will, because it includes sensitive or controversial material, such as an allegation about another person, you should request that the evidence be taken in a private session. If the committee is happy to do that, then we'll defer receipt of the confidential evidence and make alternative arrangements to receive that evidence from you. And this is to ensure that the evidence will be received in secure conditions. We presume that you're all very familiar with these sorts of procedures, but we're just going through them for the sake of being judicious. So you will be provided with a transcript of your evidence, and to assist the committee, if you do refer to a document, can you refer to its full title, and also be aware of our microphones? We might have to just muddle through a bit with the muting and the unmuting, as that does help with the quality of the audio, and obviously try our best to speak one at a time. I think, like us, you've probably become very experienced at Zoom and video conferencing calls, given the current circumstances. And I think, you know, patience and perseverance is the key. So the transcript of today's evidence will be made public, but generally, until the transcript has been made public, it should be kept private until we've done that, for the sake of making sure that it's consistent. Would any of you like to make an opening statement to the committee? Lauren, I think you're going to have to take those other two off mute, because we can't hear them if they want to talk to us.
Well, they muted.
Take themselves off.
Okay. All right. I presume you don't want to make
it. Just unmute them all. Yeah.
No, they're from those.
They keep doing it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I think, Ms. Joa, we've got some questions for you in your capacity. If you're able to unmute and come back to us.
Would you like me to start with the questions that are related to the petitions?
Yes, I think we provided those to you in advance. So,
yes, I've got them here.
Yeah, so we'll just go through those. So we'll start with the first one here. How would you describe the advantages of a petitioner being given reasons for the committee's decision? So just to let you know, we don't ordinarily provide reasons in our decision. We usually just give a summary of what information has been provided to us, unless we conduct a full inquiry into a matter where we actually table a report. We tend only to reflect that and then to close the petition. So what do you think the advantages from your point of view are in giving reasons for the committee's decisions? We can't hear. Are you there, Ms. Joel?
Can you just say the question again? Yes.
So it's the first question.
Yeah.
How would you describe the advantages of a petitioner being given reasons for the committee's decisions?
All right. I think the question relates to the processes in which we collect information using petitions, and that's an area that it's an element we use in Parliament amongst many others, including the within the public participation. So naturally, procedural officers will keep details of petitions that are received by Parliament, and these are dealt with and obviously referred to committees where necessary. There's a process where we register them, and they are regularly updated on the basis of the input of support staff, that these are the staff that is supporting committees. And if there were petitions that are similar in nature, The committee would then consider some of those petitions that are put together into a obviously a thematic way of putting them together. And the bulk of the petitions the committee received, particularly during the fifth parliament, were infrastructure related petitions. And these would obviously ensure that there's a way in which we process them and send them to the various departments. The committee considered these petitions, and a lot of them would be around adequate sanitation, effective housing infrastructure. And subsequently, the committee uses that to consider, to exercise oversight on the various portfolios that they had. And I'm sure some of the matters that I might not have covered, you could cover during the discussions, but Ms. Beck can actually add, you know, that's an area that she manages very closely. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so...
Can I respond?
Yes, of course.
The question was specifically around the advantages of a petitioner being given reasons for a committee's decision. So one of the key values of the Parliament of South Africa is openness and responsiveness. So in keeping with these values, we have a duty to inform a petitioner as to the outcome of the petition and whether the matter has been finalized. So the petition's process is actually an expression of the South African Parliament's public participation model. And this model deals extensively with our public participation processes, particularly in committees, but also in terms of how committees deal with petitions specifically. And one of the milestones of the model is premised on four milestones: inform, educate, involve. And then the last milestone is that of feedback. And in terms of our feedback milestone, committees are required to, as a matter of course, provide feedback to citizens on matters that are before the committee that pertains to a particular community, or if it's an individual petition, the petition as well. There's a definite advantage in terms of giving those reasons, not only because of the values of transparency and openness, but also that it represents Parliament in a particular light. Parliament responds to the needs of citizens, that Parliament is performing its representative role, and it is seen to be performing oversight and holding the executive to account. So in terms of the public view of Parliament, when petitioners submit petitions, I not only listen to the petition, I'm following up in terms of trying to resolve it, but on a regular basis providing feedback to the petitioner. It paints this picture of Parliament as being responsive, as being, as performing its function. You will probably note over a period of time that the trust in parliaments have decreased in a number of countries. Because there's a view that Parliament doesn't necessarily do its job. So I think that element of getting feedback, giving reasons, explaining the committee's decision is critical to try and reverse that particular view of Parliament just being another step. Thank you.
No, thank you for that. Do you find that there are any drawbacks by providing reasons in terms of people using that as an opportunity to rail against the outcome? Do you think that, I'm asking more than one question, perhaps I'll just let you answer that one. Do you think there are any drawbacks with providing reasons?
There could be. We are a multi-party democracy. If a decision doesn't go in the way of what a petitioner expected, you will find that it might be perceived as the committee being ineffective, not taking into account the machinery of government and how government operates, and the extent to which Parliament's oversight can actually deliver a particular result. So there can be negative expectations attached to providing things that I think overall that is not necessarily being the case. In my experience, both at the provincial level and the limited experience that I've had in Parliament, but also at the provincial level, you do find if you take citizens through the process and they have a clear understanding of how petitions are dealt with, and if the committee at the outset indicates the extent of the powers that they have, and if it's understood, then I think there's an understanding towards the end as to what it is that committees can do and the extent to which the committee can actually make sure that a school is built, that there's sanitation provided in an area. And sometimes these oversight processes, they do take time, because our role is essentially that to ensure that the executive performs, but ultimately the executive is going to allocate the budget that would make sure a particular department executes a particular function. Yes, so but feedback, I think, from our experience in terms of developing the public participation model and our engagements with citizens, one of the things that they have actually said that they would want Parliament to improve on that. They would want to see that representative role more clearly, even if it's a negative message, but as long as there is feedback. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that. Did you have any questions arising from that?
Mm-hmm.
So moving on to our next question, how would you describe the advantages of a petitioner being permitted to attend a committee meeting to consider their petition? So it's not something we would ordinarily do unless we conduct a formal hearing, but it seems to me from what we understand of your process that you seem to have a much lower bar for people to jump to come before the committee to make their case. So what do you think the advantages of that is?
Can I suggest, I see the chairperson has joined us, but she will pertain to this question. It's question 1.2, Honourable Peter.
Okay, yes, thank you. Welcome to you, chairperson, for joining us. I think you're still muted, so we can't hear you if you're speaking. No, you're muted from your...
Maybe that question can be dealt with by the content advisor.
Yeah,
I will do that. I see that my chairperson is still muted. In relation to petitions and the process that the committee undertakes, when a petition is referred to our committee, in all events we have what is called a petition hearing. So included in the petition itself, we have addendums to that petition. That is then researched extensively, and then we have a petition hearing where we invite the petitioner to attend a hearing with the committee, and we also invite implicated stakeholders. So whether it's an arm of local government or an administrative body, we all sit together in a room and we have a hearing. The process is that the petitioner would present the facts first, then the members of the committee are then given an opportunity to ask clarity-seeking questions. And we found that this process helps us quite substantially, because we can't base our recommendations solely on the documents that we receive from the petitioner. In the same light, the stakeholders or the implicated stakeholders are also then given an opportunity to present their side of the story or facts on the matter, and members of the committee are then also given the opportunity to ask those stakeholders questions. And the committee then also goes a step further. We also find that sometimes there are instances where it is difficult to ascertain further information without doing an inspection of a certain area where, for example, the petition refers to road infrastructure or relates to any other infrastructure. There was a petition, for example, where there was a lack of adequate sewerage. And the committee had then, as part of its work, conducted an inspection in loco, is what we call it. And all members including the petitioner and the implicated stakeholders, visit that particular area across South Africa, depending on where the petition emanates from, to conduct an inspection in loco, to actually go and physically do an inspection and a site visit to see whether what the standards of look like really.
And in terms of how that actual committee hearing is run, petitioner's hearing, how formal is it? How, what's the process? I mean, we're just trying to get an understanding of, is there like a hierarchy or is it relatively relaxed? How do you usually approach that?
The petition hearing is, it's not a roundtable discussion. I saw that in one of your questions you were asking whether it is a roundtable discussion where everyone gets an opportunity to speak. It's a quite a formal process, in fact. Members sit on the one side of the house while the petitioner and the implicated stakeholders sit on the other side of the house. When the chairperson introduces the petition or the matter, the chairperson then goes through the petition briefly, but also latching onto what Ms. Begg had said, the chairperson gives an indication to the petitioner as to what the extent of the powers of the committee is. So then first petitioner is then given an opportunity to present facts, and then members are allowed to ask questions. This is the process. Then the implicated stakeholders are then given an opportunity to present facts on the matter, and then members are then allowed to ask the implicated stakeholders questions. So procedurally, that is how it's done. The petitioner is given the first opportunity to present facts.
Okay. And can they be represented in these matters? By a lawyer, for example?
Legally speaking?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be a lawyer, but by a lawyer or an advocate.
Yes, there are many instances where a petitioner is represented by someone else. However, we do require that when a petition is submitted, it must be penned by the petitioner him or herself. So even if at the hearing someone speaks on behalf of the petitioner, the petition must be penned by the petitioner him or herself.
And the those that come to answer, do they also have a right for representation of any kind? Stakeholders?
Oh, the relevant stakeholders? Well, they mostly include, depending on the nature of the petition. What we've dealt with and what we've seen is that it mostly refers to local government bodies. And they are quite well represented within themselves as government.
Okay, and would they, so some of the affected stakeholders, would they include private citizens or companies?
We have actually not seen many petitions where the petitioner had petitioned our committee against a company per se. It was really most of the petitions that we've received thus far were petitions where the aggrieved member of the public had submitted a complaint against a local government department.
Okay. All right.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Cole here. So that process you just outlined about some research and then having a hearing, followed potentially by an inspection, is that written into the committee's standing orders, or is it in part of the rules of the committee?
The committee currently has rules in place, but the rules do not outline the process and the procedure that I just discussed. The committee relies on the guidelines which were adopted by the committee in 2015. But also in relation to that, I must add that this financial year, the committee will be focusing on legislating its power and mandate, so actually having a National Petitions Act, and that's the work that the committee will be doing moving forward. The other parliaments, provincial parliaments at least, all have petitions committees, and they also all have their own legislative mandate. They are guided by their own act. So moving forward for this financial year, a large focus of our committee would be to concretize its mandate and the rules in the form of an act.
Wow.
And in fact, we have a draft act in place already.
And is that supported by all the parties as a general approach?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I said, is that supported by all the political parties, or is it being proposed by the government?
Well, the committee had initially, since we have adopted the guidelines in 2015, we had, as Ms. Baker has also indicated, we have come a little short in terms of our responsiveness. So as a committee collectively, we then approached Parliament's in-house legislative drafting unit to draft this goal for us, so that we could concretize our rules and have more clout, as it were.
Okay. And in terms of the...
Some information to what this name has indicated. I worked in the provincial legislature before and was responsible for drafting the Petitions Act for the provincial legislature. Our experience has been that, if I compare what happens at provincial level and at Parliament, that our Petitions Committee at Parliament is bogged down by a lot of administrative work. In view of the fact that there's not that separation between the administrative part of dealing with petitions and then the actual committee work in terms of performing oversight and processing the petitions. And what we find quite useful with all the provincial legislatures having their own legislation is that it separates that. You create a petitions office, that the role there is also to assist citizens to be able to submit petitions, to teach them, to go through an education drive, but then also to do the administrative part of assessing the petition before it is formally referred to a committee. And that's why the legislative group also is clear timelines, guidelines in terms of what the rights of the petitioner is, what the role and responsibility of the committee is. And my experience has been having that piece of legislation in place places a responsibility on the committee to deal with the petition expeditiously, but also divorces the administrative processing of it. So the committee is purely focused on the committee function. And I think that's been the advantage of the manner in which quite a few legislatures have been able to deal with petitions more successfully. Thank you.
Thanks.
Happy to move on?
Yeah. So just to clarify finally in relation to the petitioner hearings, do members themselves make a decision on the petition at the time of the attendance, or do they defer their decision making and give consideration and deliberation to it at a later time?
I will respond to that question. The members do not decide on the petition or the finality of the petition at that meeting. At that initial petition hearing, in some instances actually we find that we may need to have additional petition hearings in relation to a certain petition because it's just too exhaustive and one can't deal with a certain petition in one hearing or one sitting only. But in relation to when the committee decides, the petitioner is not present. Our committee refers to that process as deliberation, consideration, and adoption.
Yeah.
So once the petition hearing has taken place, support staff to the committee, which includes myself and the committee secretary, we draft a petition hearing report. The report gives an indication of the facts of the petition, what the petitioner had said, the facts in relation to stakeholders, and then finally the report ends with observations and findings, and then most importantly recommendations. So when the committee finally sits to deliberate, as it were, on the petition, the committee considers this report and they actually then have a discussion to populate the recommendations, which is then tabled in the House. So that is the process.
Okay, thank you. Now, in your draft petitions guidelines, it also states that the committee may offer relief to a petitioner who can show that they have exhausted all other lawful or appropriate avenues of relief. Are you able to describe for us the avenues of relief a petitioner must have exhausted before petitioning, before you get onto that process?
With the petition process and petitioning Parliament, as Ms. Beg has said, and the Acting Secretary to Parliament as well, petitions are usually screened by procedural officers. Mm. So what these procedural officers look out for when they look at a petition is whether the petitioner has referred the matter to local government, to provincial government, to the petitions committee within the province, or even to a Chapter 9 institution. So those are all other remedies, as it were. And the petitions process in the National Council of Provinces is of course, for last resort for a petitioner, really.
Can I ask a question there?
Yeah, go on, mate.
So just following that, how do the petitioners... Sorry, Madam Chair?
Can I add?
Yes, go.
I just want to put on examples of illustrating the following of procedures. For instance, if the petitioner is complaining about the house that is not properly constructed, the first thing that we check is the person did refer the matter to the municipality, and the municipality, they did talk to the Department of Human Settlement, which is responsible, is the custodian of constructing of housing. So if those steps have not been followed, then the petition has to be turned back so that those are exhausted, and we take it when there are no longer avenues for them to pursue the matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just want to, follow on my question. So is the petitioner, are they required to show the proof of exhausting all avenues, or is that part of the research done by the committee?
Definitely, through your chair, if they present their case, they have to give us a documentation that shows us they did write to the municipality, they didn't get the response, and then again they follow up on the matter, there was no response. And again, we check with the Department of Human Settlements if they did receive a letter to the petitioner. Then if the Department of Human Settlements didn't get any communique in terms of that, we then inform the petitioner to first go to the Department of Human Settlements, so that when they don't have joy finally there, it's then that the NCOP, through the Office of the Chair, after being processed by our officials that are responsible to process the petitions, then it comes back to us.
Okay, thank you.
So it would be fair to say that your committee is a committee of last resort for people, that they have exhausted all their other avenues and then they come to you as the last a point to seek the relief that they're after.
Definitely.
And how many petitions or petitioners would you receive and then in a year, and then ask them to do more work seeking relief elsewhere? What proportion of your petitions petitioners would that constitute?
I would not be able off the cuff to give you the actual figures. How many are they? But I can make one example from a petition that we're dealing with this term, sixth parliament. We received a petition that is land related from a traditional leader. We did process the petition, and we find out that the matters that the petitioner is raising they are still with the National Assembly for processing of the section of the Constitution. So we said, no, this matter is still with the National Assembly. We cannot handle it as of now. Wait for the process to be finalized. Then you see if your matter will not be dealt with. So it's just one example of a case of a matter that is still with another institution or else a house, in this case, the NA. So the NA is busy dealing with the issue of land. So we cannot, as NSOP, start giving a decision on a matter that is land-related. Thank you.
No, thank you for that. We might put that question to you on notice, if you don't mind, just to get some idea about how many of those petitioners are turned around, because in our system, it's not a very high bar for them to get before the committee. So, but we do get some petitions that probably could have gone off to other people for assistance before coming to us. So we'd be interested to know what your statistics are. So we'll put that question to you in writing after our hearing today. And I do appreciate that there will be some times you won't be able to answer our questions off the cuff. Do you have a parliamentary ombudsman or that kind of body within your system that you also work with? Because we have one here in Western Australia, and we do ask petitioners whether they've sought assistance from the ombudsman. Invariably, they've never have, but or very rarely do. But do you have such a body of that kind in within the South African parliaments? It's open to anyone to answer that question if you want. No, I'll take it.
I can't answer that question. We don't have a parliamentary ombudsman.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, that's good. We have to tick that question off. Okay, so just in terms of the draft petitions guidelines, further state that a petition must not have been considered by the committee previously or be currently before the committee unless it contains new information that may materially impact on the outcome of the reconsideration of the matter. Our committee has been referred a number of petitions in the current parliament and in previous parliaments for that matter that are substantially similar to petitions it has already considered. Can you, so from your point of view and from your end, can you give us an idea of the criteria that are used to determine whether a petition is the same or substantially the same as one previously considered, and who undertakes that role?
If I may respond to that.
Yes.
As I've also already indicated, procedural officers are tasked with screening a petition. Mm. They also tasked with keeping the register of the petition, and the petition is allocated a petition number. They also note briefly the contents of the petition before it is referred to our committee. So more often than not, our committee receives the petition anew, as I'm not sure if I'm responding to your question.
Sorry, are you there?
Oh, sorry, I saw the internet connection.
We did lose you for a moment. Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm responding to your question.
No, yes, fine. No, you're doing well. Thank you. Yep. I think you...
No. I'm asking you for the DIA. There was a break in the connection. So.
Oh, right.
So
yeah.
What I meant to say was that it is highly unlikely that the committee will receive the same petition unless there are new matters that the petitioner has brought. When a petition is referred to the committee, it is referred to the committee anew from the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Yeah, I note one of the powers of the committee is that it can, if requested by the petitioner, resolve a dispute or complaint. Can you explain to me what that actually means in terms of the role that's actually undertaken there? Because I read the materials you provided to me, it wasn't really apparent as to how you would resolve the complaint. Is that between private citizens or between a private citizen and the government? And I think I recall it did mention mediation I can't recall the other word, but it did refer to arbitration, it might have been. So if you could elaborate on that role that the committee performs there and how it actually conducts that role.
Okay, I'll respond to that question. As indicated previously, the bulk of the committee's work is hosting petition hearings. And through that petition hearing process, the committee inadvertently conducts a dispute resolution process. Since the committee brings together the petitioner as well as the implicated stakeholder, who could either be a local government department or another administrative body. So through that process and through the process of hosting petition hearings, I would say that the bulk of the work of the committee is actually dispute resolution in nature.
And how effective do you think you perform that role, if you don't mind me asking a loaded question?
That is a loaded question. The committee tables the report and it includes recommendations in that report. Parts of the recommendations usually require the stakeholder to perform. And in some instances, we also attach timeframes within which a stakeholder should report back to a committee. So prior to us actually tabling the report, we indicate to a stakeholder that they should report back to us within 3 months on any progress they've made in relation to a petition. So in that way, the committee sort of has a checks and balances process, but through the tabling of the reports and through the recommendations process, the committee is then able to follow up on whether the stakeholder had performed or not.
And what's your big stick to use with your stakeholders to make sure they comply with your guidelines and your timeframes?
Excuse me?
Your big stick, how do you keep them in order to comply with your, I'm using a bit of an idiom here, but I'm sure in South Africa using a big stick probably has the same meaning as it does here, but how do you compel them to comply with your timeframes in terms of doing that? Because obviously stakeholders, if they've not been inclined to do the right thing to begin with, are often not inclined to do that unless there's some sort of mechanism to ensure that they do. So how do you effectively get them to follow your recommendations, or don't they follow your recommendations?
The first step in the process is that we do follow ups ourselves. So as a committee, the administrative staff of the committee, in fact, call the relevant stakeholder and request the feedback reports. But in terms of having an actual mechanism in place, the committee needs to bolster that somewhat.
Yeah.
And I think that possibly through having an enacted piece of legislation, that could be incorporated, that power for the committee to have the stakeholder comply could be incorporated into a piece of legislation.
I was just going to follow up with that question, and maybe Madam Chair can answer it, but is the committee considered quite a powerful committee within Parliament and South African society?
Can I just respond and sort of try and respond to that? And the Chair, I'm sure, will add also. I think the first thing, it's got to do with the complexity of what is being petitioned. The second thing would be, is it something that is
articulated or activated by a particular law, which makes it slightly easier for Parliament to persuade whoever is responsible to address the contents or the complaint of the petitioner. For example, if it's about a delivery of a service and it is as a result of a budget passed by the Houses, the Parliament has got more power and more strength to intervene through its oversight, and also getting the Cabinet Minister reporting or seeing how they actually implementing or addressing the complaints of the petitioner. So my sense is that it will really depend on the complexity thereof. And of course, I'm sure the chairperson can even say more on some of these matters that would have related to a petitioner. But the sense is that there's definitely complexity. Some of it is a long-term process. I mean, I think even an example of a road that was rebuilt to join two provinces, it's been on the agenda for many years, and continuously members of parliament have continuously asked the minister responsible on why is it that that road is not delivered, because it should open up opportunities for the economy and small economies to emerge. The biggest thing is there's an argument around the environment, which is to say if you build a road through here, you're going to destroy the nature of that area. Just giving an example of how massive some of these things can be. And I'm certain that the chairperson can now say more on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, do you want to say something?
Thank you very much. I'm in agreement with the Secretary that these matters, sometimes they are quite complex. But if one can maybe go back to the example that I've given you earlier, trying to simplify the issue. If, for instance, the matter is about housing, as I have indicated, and both municipality and the department at that level, maybe it's in one of our regions, they are not following on the matter, our recourse then becomes of tabling a report in-house, and then thereafter we make a recommendation that says we need to engage with the minister on the matter so that the minister is able to give a directive to start a province that is having a problem. So those are the steps that we would take if the matter is not being handled. You will exhaust all the avenues. Thereafter, we go to the minister that is responsible if it is service delivery related. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may add to that, committee is obviously an extension of the House. So the committee report would go to the House for debate. And those recommendations that are made by the committees will now, once passed by the House, become resolutions of Parliament. And it's communicated either by the Speaker of the National Assembly or Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces to the Executive. What we have tried to do is to put in a system of what we call resolution tracking to monitor those resolutions that have been adopted and to make sure that there's responsiveness from the executive, i.e. if the committee's proposed that a school needs to be built or that a fence needs to be built around the school, etc., there needs to be a response from the executive on those reports that have been adopted by the council. It's an area that we need to improve and close the loop again between committee recommendations and resolutions that's been adopted by us, and this is something that we are working on currently. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just conscious of our time because we are coming to the end of our hearing. We still do have a few more questions, which I'm sure you've prepared for, so it might be worthwhile for us to ask that you provide to us a written response to the remaining questions if it's not too much to impose upon you. We've got, I'm sure, lots more questions, and I think one of the things that's enjoyable about this is we're a committee that has a very similar, almost identical purpose as to what you've got, and to be able to talk to other people that are in the same boat as what we are is very good to be able to do that. And I think the short hour that we've had together is not enough, unfortunately, to really share those experiences and to learn from what you're doing. And one of the things I think that was particularly important for us to speak to your parliament is that of all parliaments around the world, I suspect you do the most on petitions than everybody does. And I think that's something that other parliaments in the Westminster tradition can probably learn from and improve on. So as I say, I think we've come to the end of our time right now. So we will send you or follow up with those questions we haven't been able to get to. And I do appreciate that you've made yourself all available for us. What will happen from here is that we will finalise the transcript that's being prepared by our Hansard, and that will be sent to each of you to review and to correct anything that's on there. I think our Hansard is very good, but I suspect that there are some things due to the technology might have been lost in translation or lost in transmission, probably more appropriately. Just review what's in there and let us know about the corrections. And what we'll also do is provide at the time any copies of the questions on notice and in writing that we would like you to address for us. Our process from here is we've got a couple more hearings to hear from other parliaments and some experts in this field, but we hope to be able to prepare a report to be tabled in our parliament sometime towards the end of this year. And I hope you look out for it, because I think, you know, if parliaments can learn from each other, I think that's a really positive thing. So thank you for attending today. As I say, just until the transcript is finalised, please keep it private. And if there's any inquiries, please direct them to our committee clerks. Okay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.